couch potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. On today's show, I'm going to be talking about the new movies Ocean's 8, Hereditary, Hotel Artemis, and First Reform. There's also going to be the news, the trailer park, and the home cinema roundup featuring The Midnight Man and A Wrinkle in Time. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, you can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com or facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. And if you want to reach out to me on Twitter, I'm at twitter.com/KevinCarr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
There's really only one news story that has been dominating film news in particular this week, and that is Kelly Marie Tran, who played the character of Rose in The Last Jedi, had deleted her Instagram account because she was being harassed by bullies, and they were making racist and sexist comments throughout the section. And she was basically being attacked via social media, which is something that happens a lot. And before I really even start talking about this, I want to make sure I point out up front that anything I say in this is not in any way an endorsement or an excuse of any of this kind of behavior. There's a lot of online bullying that goes on, everywhere from just standard high school kids to things on the national stage. And that kind of behavior is not right. And it should be curtailed whenever possible. Now, with all that said, we have to realize this is nothing new. This reaction that fans, and I put fans in quotes, have to celebrities, people are reacting like this is brand new. Go back almost 20 years ago when episode 1 came out, when the internet was kind of in its infancy. People who are out there defending Kelly Tran now and shaming Star Wars fans in general in some weird way were the ones who were right up there. The film Twitter mentality were the ones out there crucifying Jake Lloyd, a child who was just playing a part. These armchair critics and these average viewers are the ones that did turn on Jake Lloyd, and they made fun of him. And all these people that are defending Kelly Tran were ones who were ready to pile on everyone from Hayden Christensen in the Star Wars movies to Ahmed Best, who was the actor who played Jar Jar Binks. So this is nothing new. People lashing out at the actors of their favorite movies because something happened in it, or the latest movie wasn't what they wanted it to be. The other thing is, you got to remember, this is a fan behavior, and this isn't a general fan behavior. I'm talking about the term fanatic behavior comes from. I remember reading, my mom used to subscribe, or she, I don't know if she subscribed to it, but she'd get it from the supermarket, Soap Opera Digest, back in the 80s during the heyday of soap operas. And I remember one time it was in the bathroom. Hey, I didn't bring in any reading material for myself, so I picked up a copy of this and I was looking through it, and they had this little piece in there about the stars of soap operas talking about some of the weirdest encounters they've had with fans. And there were stories of people who played villains in the soap opera being accosted at the supermarket while they're buying their groceries for the things that the character did. So this ability of fans to blur the line between actor and character is nothing new. It's gone on for decades. It predates the internet. And the reality of social media, though, is now it makes it accessible to everybody. I mean, in the past, if you were going to accost a soap opera actor, you kind of had to just be in the same room with them. Well, now everybody's online and you have access to them. And if there's 100 million Star Wars fans out there, which I think is a very conservative estimate, 1% of 1% of that is still 10,000 people. And those 10,000 people can wreak a lot of havoc on a certain person from all over the globe. And some of these people are just trolls. Some of the people who post this kind of garbage, they don't even care. They don't have a horse in this race. They just like to create drama and set fires on the internet. So I've seen a lot of these articles say Star Wars fans drive Kelly Tran from Instagram. It wasn't Star Wars fans. It was this weird fringe 1% of 1% who beat the drum and say they're Star Wars fans. And then everybody says, oh, look at you awful nerds. I mean, even Mark Hamill had this post on Twitter that says, get a life, nerds. I mean, which he's got a lot of talk room to talk. He dealt with this in the 70s. And I remember reading another post where somebody says, isn't this strange that they're not driving Adam Driver off of the internet, or they're not driving, Oscar Isaac or Rian Johnson? Oh, what's the difference here? Because, you know, Kelly Tran's a woman and she's Asian. There's a racial issue there. But I also think it might just be that she's an actress. She's a 20-something actress who is not well-known. She got fame thrust into her life. And, I mean, she should have expected this, because it's not like The Last Jedi was this little independent film that blew up and nobody knew it was going to be big. But I think also I've known enough actresses in my life that this kind of thing's going to hurt them. And it's also Instagram. It'd be one thing if it was going on this Star Wars fan forum. Yeah, police your own. But it's Instagram. It's Instagram. That's accessible to everybody. That's not just a Star Wars fan thing. And so, yeah, there's a lot to not like about Rose, the character. I'm sure Kelly Tran's just a wonderful person, but she probably doesn't have that thick of a skin. She's going to have to get one. If you're going to live in the world and play a part that could potentially polarize even 1% of 1% of a giant fan base, you just got to get a thicker skin. I mean, look at somebody, and I'm not getting political here, but look at Donald Trump. I mean, if you want to talk about somebody, say what you want to about Donald Trump one way or the other as a politician or president, that guy doesn't care what you say to him on Twitter. He just tunes that stuff out. Or Kim Kardashian. I'm sure there's plenty of hate spewed at Kim Kardashian through her social media feeds. But she somehow manages to deal with it. You get millions of followers because you're in Star Wars movies, you're going to get trolls along with it. I mean, look, if you can harass a racist lawyer in New York City for yelling at a sandwich person because they don't speak English, then you're going to get people who can harass somebody because they didn't like something her character did in a movie that she had nothing to do with besides just acting. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the trailer park. Two real quick ones. The first one I want to talk about is A Star Is Born, which opens on October 5th.
I always knew, you were going to do something, that you'd be all right. It's the first time I'm worried about you.
Can I ask you a personal question?
Okay.
Do you write songs or anything?
I don't sing my own songs.
Why?
I just don't feel comfortable.
Why wouldn't you feel comfortable?
Almost every single person has told me they like the way I sounded, but that they didn't like the way I look.
I think you're beautiful.
Now, this is Bradley Cooper's directorial debut, which is, I think, interesting enough. This movie doesn't appeal to me. It does feel like it has a lot of influences of Clint Eastwood, who was originally, I think, wanting to direct this, but of course now Bradley Cooper is, and I'm sure, and I know he had a hand in the producing. This doesn't appeal to me, just as the original remake didn't appeal to me. The original one was okay. I've seen it, but it's not my favorite. I think this is a directorial debut is only going to be taken with a grain of salt, because you never know who's directing it for real. Because sometimes a big celebrity like Bradley Cooper is going to get his hand held. The next one I want to talk about is The Lego Movie 2, which opens on February 8th.
A lifetime has passed since the horrific events of Taco Tuesday. This new life has toughened and hardened us all.
Two coffees, please. One black, one with just a touch of cream and 25 sugars.
Emmett, you gotta stop pretending everything is awesome. It isn't.
Yeah, I get it.
Oh, no.
Bring me your fiercest leader.
This guy?
Now, I love the Lego movie. I love the Lego Batman movie. I even thought the Lego Ninjago movie was kind of fun. I just hope that this captures the same sort of fun that the first one did. I don't think it's going to be as fresh. It's never going to be as fresh or as surprising. So I just hope that it works and they actually have a story to it, and that it just holds together. That's my big worry, is that this is just going to be a disappointing sequel, just because you can't recapture lightning in a bottle. We'll see when that comes out next year. That's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Hereditary and Hotel Artemis. Everything is awesome. welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's jump right in with the movie reviews. I'm going to start off with the big one, or at least one that's getting a lot of buzz, and that is Hereditary. Recovering from the grief of losing her mother, a woman deals with the angst and mental illness in her family while they face an even greater tragedy and danger.
My name's Annie. My mom died a week ago. She was a very private woman, and she wasn't altogether there at the end.
Who's gonna take care of me?
You don't think I'm gonna take care of you?
When you die.
Sorry, I recognize you from your mother. How is your relationship with your daughter?
What?
Before I even talk about the film itself and just what my thoughts are of the film and even what it's about, this is one of those movies that I have to tell people you may want to tread cautiously and not get sucked in by the advertising. And the reason I say this is because if you look at the advertising, literally says at times, believe the hype. Now, I'm a huge horror movie fan. Anyone who knows me knows that. And I've gone and seen, 24-hour horror movie marathons. I watch horror movies all throughout October. I'm a big movie fan of the horror genre. So I do come at this with more knowledge than your average moviegoer or even just your average critic. I am going to say you may not want to get too wrapped up in the hype. This is the kind of movie that did very well in sort of like these festival circuits and these smaller showings. Then I saw it. I was looking forward to it. I'm like, hey, this is supposed to be a big horror movie. The first hour of the movie, not a horror movie. I mean, it sets it up, but it does not feel like a horror movie. It's sort of like, and I'm reticent to compare it to like The Birds, but if you watch The Birds, the first hour, 15 minutes of The Birds, there's no like real creepy, weird things happening in The Birds. It's just this story of this guy trying to follow this woman that he was attracted to. And that's almost a whimsical romance in The Birds. And in this one, this is not a horror movie from the beginning. You don't feel like it's a horror movie. It does have these horror movie elements and it's shot like a horror movie, but it's really just a movie about grief. I mean, it's just an emotionally gut-wrenching film because it's a story of this family dealing with the grief and the loss of the grandmother. And then something, I'm not going to say what happens, but other things happen and it just gets even more grief-stricken. And I mean, there's great performances. I mean, Toni Collette, certainly doesn't phone it in. She's there for every single frame of this film, and she does a great job, and I can see this as a role that an actor would just get all excited to play because there's so much emotion wrapped up into it. And she does a great job, and Alex Wolff, I think Alex Wolff overdoes it at times. He's her son in the movie. But it really is, it just kind of turns into this misery porn for the first hour. I'm like, because I'm halfway through the movie, and I was like, when's the horror elements going to, when is it going to be horror? I mean, we have hinted at it here and there, and it just takes forever to get to that. And then when they finally get to the bona fide horror elements, which has some neat stuff in there, but some of it does certainly seem derivative, it's this deliberately paced nature, which I guess is fine, and I don't mind a good deliberately paced movie now and then. I loved The Witch, and I loved No Country for Old Men. Those are extremely deliberately paced films, but part of it is when they do deliberately pace some of these horror elements, it's like you take so long to reveal something, and then you go into another room, and it takes so long to reveal something else, and I'm just like, get on with it already. I just couldn't connect with the characters because it was just buckets of grief from the beginning, and I'm not into that. I gotta have something else to hang your hat on for me to actually enjoy the movie. I didn't feel empathy for the family. I felt pity for them, but I didn't really get an emotional connection to them. For all the emotion that's in this movie, I just never felt it. And I know people are just loving this film, but I also think it's going to be very polarizing. I think A24, who's releasing it, is hoping it's going to be like A Quiet Place, which was this tiny little film, and it's a horror movie independently produced that blew up. It's not like A Quiet Place. A Quiet Place is very accessible to the mainstream. This, I think, is going to be more like It Comes at Night. If you remember that movie from last year, that was mismarketed as a horror movie when really it was more of a family drama, really, was what that was, with some, and I wasn't a huge fan of that movie, but that movie got just savaged by audiences because they were expecting a bona fide Monster in the Woods horror movie that would be accessible, and it wasn't. It was an art house film, and this is an art house film. And some people are comparing it to The Witch, and I think there's a difference. I think what polarized people on The Witch, was the deliberate pacing, but also the fact the movie was in like Middle English or Old English, and it was very hard to understand at times. I mean, just the dialogue. This is different. You understand what's going on. It just takes forever to get there. And even when they do an artistic horror movie, they rely on the, we're going to make the characters really stupid kind of elements. Reminds me a little bit of Annihilation, that sci-fi movie by Alex Gardner with Natalie Portman. We talked about it last week. That was a movie that still relied on just the main character being stupid. Anyway, when it comes to Hereditary, for the right audience, it'll be a great film. I personally did not like it. And I know there are some people who love this, and there's layers to it. I mean, there really are. There's layers and symbolism, and you can say, well, it's really about this, and this is happening at this point. I mean, you can really dissect the film, and I think that's cool that that's in there. It's just, it was a lot to get through. So I'm going to have to say that I think Hereditary kind of sucks.
It kind of sucks.
Wait a second. I don't like the sound of that.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's continue on with the movie reviews and talk about Hotel Artemis. A group of criminals are under fire when they check into a hotel that serves as a secret hospital for the underworld.
Hello. How can I help?
Easy, fellas. Everybody's going to get fixed up. Now verify your memberships, and we're off to the races.
The Artemis is a secret hospital for criminals.
I thought you were done with all this.
I got out, but you know how it goes.
You're never out. Not up here.
I thought this place was a myth.
We've been here for 22 years. This hospital was built on two things. Trust. And rules.
The Artemis isn't safe for us.
This reminds me of John Wick. That hotel that all the assassins met in, and within the walls of the hotel, they couldn't carry on any grudges. They had to obey the rules. It reminds me a lot of that, at least from the advertising. They didn't screen this one. I directly asked for a screening or a screener, like even just an online screener. Nope. And whenever that happens, I always have to question how much faith the studio has in it. If they're going to say, we are going to go out of our way to not show this to you. So take this movie with a grain of salt, because I don't know how good it is. I mean, it looks like it's an interesting concept, and it's got a great cast. You've got, Jodie Foster's in it playing kind of an off-kilter role for her, which is kind of cool. And you've got Jeff Goldblum in it. It looks like he plays a bad guy. Sterling K. Brown's in it. I mean, I'm not thrilled. I mean, he's okay. I could take him or leave him. But, you got Charlie Day. You've got Sophia Boudella, I think is her name. She's the one who's in The Mummy, and I think she was in one of the Kingsman movies. So it looks like it has an interesting cast, but it does feel like it might kind of break down at a certain point. This is one I'll probably check out on video, simply because this is the kind of movie that I mentioned in talking about Hereditary, that I would go to these 24-hour horror movie marathons, sci-fi movie marathons. This is the kind of movie that I would have expected to see in the sci-fi marathon, because it does take place in sort of this, has these futuristic elements to it, where I could see that as a sort of like an offshoot film that they would show at that, like at 3 a.m. That would be kind of fun, but you could say, yeah, it's imperfect. I don't know. This one has to get a preemptive suck, though, because they didn't screen it. So take that, criminals in a hotel.
It sucks.
That's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Ocean's 8 and First Reformed.
All right, fellas.
And welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's continue on with the movie reviews. And let's jump into the ocean with Ocean's 8. Immediately upon being released from prison, Danny Ocean's sister Debbie plans an elaborate jewel heist to take place at the Metropolitan Gala in New York.
Debbie Ocean, convicted felon. Her brother, Danny Ocean, more convicted felon. She was present on the night of the incident.
So you want to hit a jewelry store?
Not exactly.
In 3.5 weeks, the Met will be hosting its annual ball, and we are going to rob it.
Oh, lucky you.
$16.5 million in each of your bank accounts 5 weeks from now.
That's a lot.
This started off as a stunt casting type experiment, and a lot of people compare this to the Ghostbusters remake. And I think there is a difference there. Part of it with Ghostbusters is it was very much a stunt casting remake version of the movie. And ultimately, when Ghostbusters was all said and done, it wasn't that good of a movie. It was okay. It wasn't terrible. But Ghostbusters also wasn't very good. Also, Ghostbusters didn't feel like it was cut from the original Ghostbusters cloth. I also got to remember that when the Ghostbusters came out, the first one, that was a big hit. The second one was kind of stunk. This is different in the sense that, first of all, the Ocean's movies, Ocean's 11, 12, and 13, the remakes, the ones with Soderbergh. I'm not talking about the original Frank Sinatra movie. But, you know, it's been, what, about 10 years since the last Ocean's 13 came out. So it's not like you're working against nostalgia and the blowback from that. Because, I mean, you're only talking 10 years ago, as opposed to the Ghostbusters, which was like a 30-year difference. And this is also not remaking Ocean's 11. It's not like they said, let's make Ocean's 11, but let's just put it with women instead of men. This does use women for a heist, but it's a brand new movie. It isn't, it's connected to the others because of the characters of brother and sister, but it is its own separate movie. It's just a new heist film. It's just existing within that universe. I hardly would even call it a sequel, more or less a spinoff than anything else. So I think that's part of the reason this one has a certain amount of success in its execution. Now it stars Sandra Bullock. And I think it's hilarious that the second she gets out of prison, she's like, let's go ahead. And she doesn't even wait. I mean, it's like that afternoon from getting out of prison, she's talking to Cate Blanchett. And like the other Ocean's movies, it's really Ocean's 3, where you've got Sandra Bullock, Cate Blanchett, Helena Bonham Carter. Then, of course, you have Anne Hathaway, but she's the mark. And then you have the next tier down, where you've got TV stars. And I love Mindy Kaling, but she's best known for TV. And you've got Sarah Paulson, who's best known for TV, especially now after American Horror Story. And then you go even farther ratcheting down and you've got like Rihanna, who, I mean, I guess she's fine in this movie. She's not as god awful as she was in like Battleship. But then you got Awkwafina, whoever the heck that is. You know, I joke that it should be Ocean's 3 plus a bunch of other people you've heard of. But even the Ocean's 11, 12, and 13, by the time you got to 8 or 9 on those lists, those are people who should never have been on a movie poster in the first place. They weren't going to sell tickets. It's just you got to have to fill out the cast. And they couldn't do Ocean's 3 because for a heist, you need multiple people to really make it fun. Now, ultimately, this movie, it delivers exactly what you'd expect. It's this hip and pop heist movie where you're rooting for the bad guys. You want to see kind of how they do the heist and where the twists and turns are and where the different layers are, because there's always layers to the different elements of the heist. And there's always more stuff to be revealed. And is there, are we at the end of the heist? Is there another turn that's going to happen? So it does fit that mold completely. And that's what makes it fun. It's very much an Ocean's movie and it has less of Brad Pitt eating chips. So I guess that's a good thing. There are a couple things that I find interesting about this being that female empowerment. Oh, women in their over 40 making movies and being headlining stars. I still find it odd when they have a movie like this. It's like, oh, it's a female empowerment, but we're going to have a guy direct it. And no flies on Gary Ross. I mean, he did a fine job directing. I mean, it's not as punchy as the Soderbergh versions, but that I think is the style. But I think Gary Ross did a fine job directing it. But I still think it falls into that realm of we can put actresses in a movie, but we certainly can't have a woman write or direct this movie because they wouldn't know what to do. So I do think that does run counter to that argument. The other thing I find funny, and this is all just, this has nothing to do with the movie. This is all just in terms of sort of like the social awareness and the woke factor of this movie. In the Ocean's movies, you have them like robbing a Vegas casino and doing art dealers and I think it was the second one, the Ocean's 12. And this one, of course, the ladies have to steal jewels. And of course, an angle to this has to be the fashion world, which does seem a little sexist to a degree. And then even they have another character played by Richard Armitage, and it's sort of like there's a little bit of boyfriend revenge in this. So it does still have, this movie does still kind of reek of sexism in a lot of ways. And even beyond that, if you look at like the women of color in this movie, all the white women are like high-end criminals. Sandra Bullock's a high-end heist planner. You got Cate Blanchett runs her own distribution company, Sarah Paulson, hijacks stuff and fences it on the high-end market. And then you have Rihanna, who's a street hacker. And you've got Awkwafina, who's basically running three-card Monty in Central Park. So I think, and even Mindy Kaling, yeah, she's not like the street criminal, but she works in some crappy Indian jewelry store. So, I mean, all the white women have a higher tier just immediately in this movie than the women of color, which I think does still show the stigma of Hollywood. If you really want to talk about, is this movie showing, you know, a certain amount of progression out of the 50s mentality. But that's neither here nor there, or whether you enjoy the movie. It's a fun movie. It's worth seeing. So I'm going to have to say it kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk really quickly about First Reformed. Ethan Hawke stars as a pastor for a historic Dutch Reformed church in upstate New York who is struggling with grief in his past and the extremist he has begun counseling.
Reverend Toller?
Yes, Mary?
You must come over. You must come over now.
Explosives.
She was becoming someone I didn't know.
Opportunistic diseases, anarchy, martial law. You will live to see this.
You had no idea that he was thinking of.
No, I'm so frightened.
These kids, they want certainty. You know, don't think, follow. They fall prey to extremism.
It's a world without hope.
No, I have not lost my faith.
This is written and directed by Paul Schrader, who is best known, I mean, he's done a lot of movies, but one of his most iconic movies is he wrote Taxi Driver way back in the 70s. And in a way, this movie has a lot of connective tissue with Taxi Driver. I mean, there's a lot fewer scenes in this that take place in a porno theater than in Taxi Driver. But this is a movie that deals with that mental illness and comes from a totally different perspective. And I'm not saying that Ethan Hawke's playing a character that's the same character as what Robert De Niro was doing in Taxi Driver, but this does kind of feel like in an alternate universe if Travis Bickle had become a pastor and went to this Dutch Reformed church in upstate New York and had a very quiet life. There's a lot of possible insanity happening on the screen and in the perspective of this movie. This is a slow burn, but it also has a lot to say, not just about social issues and how people process them. The knee-jerk reaction, because the extremist he's counseling is an environmental extremist, kind of an earth-first kind of crazy person. And it's easy to knee-jerk and say, oh, well, it's just preaching about the environment. And it really isn't. It's more about this guy trying to rationalize his own grief and adopting something that this other sort of fringe element introduces him to, and how he processes that into his own worldview. The message behind that is irrelevant. It's more about what this unstable person is doing with that information and that the knowledge and his own desires. It's a slow burn. It takes its time, but I do find it interesting. It's a better slow burn, in my opinion, than Hereditary. So, you know, if you want to see something very different and dark and not necessarily a fun movie, but an interesting movie that might leave you thinking a lot more, you can check out First Reform. It kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
That's it for the segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about box office and the home cinema roundup featuring The Midnight Man and A Wrinkle in Time. Welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Now that we've done the movie reviews, let's talk really quickly about the box office. Last week, once again, Solo won for the weekend, but of course the huge news was how terrible Solo was doing, even though it's its second weekend at number one. And it made just under $30 million, which was a drop of 65%. And in terms of box office numbers, that's actually a pretty steep drop. Most movies drop 50% or less. And a movie that actually has great hold, something like Black Panther, is, you know, dropping less than 40% per weekend. And even sometimes you'll see movies bump up a little bit. But, you know, like a 30 to 40% drop is pretty standard. The reason you get such a huge drop for a movie like this is, A, it was a four-day weekend. So you're going not from $103 million, you're actually going for like the lower three-day weekend of like $80-some million. But also for a big tentpole release, those tend to be quite front-loaded, and those tend to do their most business that first weekend, and they do a huge amount of business on like the Thursday night preview, and then in Friday and Saturday, and then sort of pitter out a little bit through the weekend. And everyone treated this like it was the worst thing ever to happen to Lucasfilm and Disney, when it really it hasn't. And I'll tell you why. You know what else had a drop in the mid-60% from week to week? The Last Jedi. Again, that was very front-loaded, and its opening weekend was higher than Solo by almost a factor of, by more than a factor of two. But still, that is a normal drop for a Star Wars movie at this point. That seems to be what it's settling into. You know what other movie had a drop in the mid-60%? Deadpool 2. Now, you don't see that reported because most people look at the four-day numbers, but if you look at the three-day weekend number from the first weekend of Deadpool 2 to the three-day weekend, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, so the dialing back of the audience going to Solo is about what the dialing back of the audience was going to Deadpool 2. This is why you can't always believe what's being said in the narrative, because people like to create their own narrative. I mean, still, Solo is not doing great. Solo isn't doing as well as Deadpool 2 because it had a lower opening weekend. And the people are saying, oh, Solo's going to take this bath, $100, $150 million bath for Disney. Again, a lot of times what they will do is they'll take profit and hide it. When you have a movie that doesn't do well or doesn't do as expected, that they can then write stuff off, they will do some creative accounting and shove a lot of those deficits into a movie so the other movies can be profitable, or they sometimes push down their profits so they don't have to pay dividends to people. So, you know, this business of Solo being a bomb still doesn't wash as a bomb. It's not a huge hit, but it certainly is doing fine. It's probably going to end with about $200 million, which isn't, you know, it's about on par in terms of national theatrical release for North America. That seems to be about on par with some of the Marvel movies, especially for a film that was poorly marketed, only had a trailer that came out about 3 months before the movie did, and really had no stars. The biggest star in this movie is Woody Harrelson, and he's hardly somebody to put on a movie poster that's going to bring people out of their homes and put butts in the seat. Also, it's not part of the ongoing Star Wars episode saga, so people don't see it as a necessary movie to see. Adrift was the highest new release of last week, coming in at number 3 with 11.5 million. Upgrade did a little less than 5 million for a place at number 6. And Action Point actually did significantly terrible. It made about 2.4 million, coming in at number 9. Again, talking about risk to return, I think it was like a $19 million budget. So they're not even close to even matching the budget, let alone recouping it. This does not bode well for Johnny Knoxville. And of course, this weekend, I imagine Ocean 8's gonna do well enough. Solo's gonna drop out of the top one, but it might end up in the top three. I don't know. Who knows? It all depends on how well Hereditary does, especially also how well Ocean's 8 does, and how much Solo drops. And it could very well drop below Deadpool 2. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the home cinema roundup. I'm going to cover two of them really quick because there are a couple of them that came out on DVD and Blu-ray this week. The first one I want to hit is the Disney release of A Wrinkle in Time. Three children are thrust into a time-traveling adventure as one of them searches for her father in another dimension.
You were a top student, but look at you now. You can't keep using your father's disappearance as an excuse to act out.
We heard a cry out in the universe.
My father's alive.
We believe he is, and we're here to help you find him.
We are in search of warriors.
Warriors who serve the good and the light in the universe.
Your father's trapped by an evil energy, and the only one who can stop it is you.
This was one of those misfires by Disney, and it reminds me, this year of Disney reminds me a little bit of 2012, when people were like, oh, is Disney in trouble, when John Carter came out, and it was kind of, Disney took a real bath on that movie. And then the Avengers came out a couple months later and basically said, oh, yeah, Disney doesn't need to worry about this. Well, Disney's already at the top of its game. They're both its big Marvel movies this year. Between Black Panther and Infinity War, there's enough money to fund a couple bombs, let alone movies that are just disappointing. And A Wrinkle in Time is probably more disappointing, certainly box office wise, than Solo was. But, you know, going back and looking at it on DVD and Blu-ray, there are several things in this movie that I had problems with. I didn't like the kid who played the youngest child. And the portrayal of the three witches by Reese Witherspoon, Oprah Winfrey, and Mindy Kaling were an interesting visual choice, but I don't think that they were very authentic to the book, and I don't think that they were very well done. They look kind of goofy. I do like the fact that this movie gave a more vibrant color to a fantasy world, and it wasn't just going by the heavy look of Harry Potter, which has sort of infiltrated a lot of the fantasy elements post-Harry Potter. And it was good for Harry Potter, but it doesn't need to be in every single young adult literature book turned into a movie. So in the end, A Wrinkle in Time is a neat movie. I think it's actually worth seeing with your kids. I think, especially if you've read the book, it gives an interesting perspective of it. It's also a nice exercise in what you could have left out from the book, like the one boy, the teenage boy, the love interest, who is completely pointless and worthless in this version of the film. And what to keep in, and sort of some interesting visual choices and how to adapt the movie. So I'm still going to say that A Wrinkle in Time gets a kind of rocks from me.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. The next one I want to talk about in the home cinema roundup is The Midnight Man. A group of teenagers are trapped in a house playing a deadly game with a malevolent spirit.
Is she going to be all right?
You said she fainted in the attic.
I've never seen her so scared.
You're playing the game, aren't you?
What game?
The Midnight Man. This is no game for kids or bored teenagers. The Midnight Man is utterly ruthless.
Oh, no!
If any of these rules are broken, the Midnight Man will manifest your worst nightmares.
The Midnight Man doesn't like to lose.
What's funny is I saw this a day or so after I saw Hereditary. And I know that they're very different movies. Hereditary is essentially an art house film. This is a straightforward sort of spirit ghost monster movie. It's playing off a lot of the elements of like the Insidious movies. Not as nuanced as Insidious, but it does have Lin Shaye in it. And she, of course, is at this point the backbone of the Insidious movies. It also has a bit part with Robert Englund, but as I understand it, I mean, he does pretty much any movie that comes his way. He look at his IMDb page, and it's like got like 150 movies a year. He made a career doing Freddy Krueger and got a name for himself in the horror world, and that's serving him well financially and in his career as he's in the waning ends of it. Now, with this said, The Midnight Man, if you compare it to a movie like The Bye Bye Man, which was really stupid, this one's much more effectively done. Now, the main character in it is played by, I believe, Gabrielle Huff. And she is not a good actress. She really isn't. She kind of brings the movie down. But the concept of the film and some of the tricks that they employ are actually quite chilling and effective and grisly and scary. It does have goofy moments where the effects and the costuming don't quite work out. But the idea and the setup is kind of a neat little thing. And it was funny. It's violent. It's an R-rated movie for sure. It's an R-rated level movie. It's not rated, but it would get an R rating. And it can be intense at times. And it's funny. I was watching it to review and my sons came in the room and they kind of got sucked into the movie because it's about these people playing this game in this house. Reminds you a little bit of Ouija or, like I said, The Bye Bye Man, or even Truth or Dare, where it's like the kids stumble into playing this game and there's something that haunts them. I actually enjoy this way better than Hereditary, but I, of course, recognize that that's an art house film and this is just sort of the run-of-the-mill monster flick. But in terms of pound-for-pound horror, for me, I like The Midnight Man better. So I'm going to have to say The Midnight Man kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
Other releases this week include Death Wish, Gringo, Thoroughbreds, and South Park, The Terrible Season 21. That's it for this week. When I come back next week, I'm going to be talking about The Incredibles 2 and Tag. Until then, have a fat time at the movies.